This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. It's Father's Day weekend, so we're going to start the show by revisiting the most popular story Only a Game has ever produced. And it just so happens to be a story about two dads. The first of those dads is NBA Hall of Famer and 11-time All-Star Charles Barkley.
Barkley and the foul as Houston got him.
Nowadays, Barkley is an analyst for TNT's Inside the NBA.
Listen, come on, man. You know, you can't serve cold nachos.
Oh, okay.
And the thing is, you know how, you know, some place to get you good nachos, they put jalapenos? The son's be putting pickles on it.
Barkley was raised in small-town Alabama by his mom, Charcy. When she passed away in June 2015, Barkley's whole hometown came to the funeral to pay respects. But there was also an unexpected guest. Here's reporter Shirley Wong.
Charles Barkley's friends couldn't quite place this mystery guest. He wasn't a basketball player, he wasn't a sports figure, and he wasn't from Barkley's hometown. Here's what I can tell you about him. He wore striped red polo shirts, tucked into khaki shorts, and got really excited about two-for-one deals. He was a commuter. He worked as a cat litter scientist in Muscatine, Iowa. In short, he was everyone's suburban dad. More specifically, he was my dad.
You know, it was obviously a very difficult time.
That's Charles Barkley.
And the next thing I know, he shows up. Everybody's like, who's the Asian dude over there? And I just started laughing. I said, that's my boy, Lynn. They're like, how do you know him? I said, it's a long story.
A long story that started 4 years ago.
He has a big personality.
That's my dad, Lynn Wong. I actually recorded this interview with him in 2017. He told me he knew about Charles Barkley long before he met him.
Well, yeah, he's a, you know, top 50 players in the history of the NBA. For many years, he was the number two guy, right after Michael Jordan.
Whenever we attended dinner parties, my dad would talk about his friend, Charles Barkley. The first time my dad told the story, I didn't pretend to know who this person was. Basketball has never been my thing. Like a good millennial, I Googled Charles Barkley. He seemed pretty famous, and definitely not like anyone who would be friends with my dad. About 2 years ago, I asked my dad if I could see their texts. They were mostly messages from my dad that ended with an excessive number of exclamation points. In one of the texts, in which my dad calls Barkley brother, my dad wrote, "Brother, you are so popular!" Watching your Capital One commercials in March Madness every year is almost like eating turkeys in Thanksgiving! It has become a must-do thing in March! Good for you! I told my dad the conversation seemed pretty one-sided and handed the phone back. As I talked about the relationship with more and more people, I began to think that either my dad was one of the luckiest basketball fans ever, or this whole thing was an elaborate joke, a dinner for schmucks type situation. But no, the friendship was real.
It was like one of the most random things.
Yeah, I was on a business trip and stayed in one of the hotels and was working in the lobby, and I saw Charles Barkley.
I was in Sacramento speaking at a charity event.
So I just wanted to say hi. I wanted to take a picture with him.
I was just sitting at the bar, and me and your dad were the only two people in there, and we just sit down and started talking.
He's a super nice guy.
And before we knew it, we looked at each other like, yo, man, I'm hungry. And we said, well, let's go to dinner. It turned into a two-hour dinner. And then we actually went back to the bar and just sit there and talk for another couple hours. And the rest is history.
My dad and Barkley saw each other again in the bar the next night. And the night after that, at the end of the third night.
You know, certainly I told him I had a good time talking with him, hanging out with him. He said the same thing to me. And he left the phone number. He said, whenever you're in Atlanta, New York City, or Phoenix, check out with me. If I'm in town, we'll hang out, have a good time.
Over the next few years, whenever my dad was in those cities, he would text Barkley and they would hang out.
I mean, it's just a fun time. I mean, like when he came to Atlanta and came to the show and things, you know, my friends, Shaq, Ernie, Kenneth, they enjoyed just meeting him.
They got dinner together.
I think I had a Thai basil noodle. It was pretty good. I had it right inside the office.
Spent time on the set of Inside the NBA.
He likes to clean. There's several big can of cleaning wipes right on his desk. Every time he sit down, he cleans his desk.
Watched basketball games.
And Iowa lost into Maryland that day.
I'm pretty sure they did some partying too, but that I don't know much about.
Your dad is one of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. I mean, I'm not just saying it. I mean, think about it. It's fun to be with your friends. You know, because I don't have that many friends that I want to be around, to be honest with you. I mean, you know a lot of people, but when you go spend time with your friends, it's a whole different animal.
Back home, my dad's coworkers would tease him about Barkley and ask him about the story all the time. My dad didn't mind that they didn't believe him. He even made a slideshow of photos of him and Barkley together for our community's Chinese New Year celebration. Totally irrelevant to the holiday. Why do you think, out of all the people that he's interacted with, that you became friends with him? What is it about you and him that made that last?
I think we had a good conversation. We agree with each other a lot of point of views. You know, he grown up in the 70s in Alabama. His father left him and his mother when he was little. He grown up with grandma and mother, and the grandma and mother cleaned up house for somebody else to make a living. Tough life for him. But, you know, he's well respected professionally. You know, that's his story.
My dad moved to Iowa from China in the 90s. He felt that Barkley and him had similar experiences.
So to me, as an Asian in the U.S., I felt as long as I do a good job, people will respect me.
Barkley and my dad both worked hard. So hard, they believed that the color of their skin didn't matter. In Chinese, we'd say that dad sometimes would hushu badao. That meant that sometimes he was known for spewing rubbish. I know that basketball fans might say Barkley often does the same.
Remembering the mother of Charles Barkley, today folks in Leeds said goodbye to Charcy Glenn. She died at her home this week.
When my dad heard on the news that Barkley's mother had passed away, my dad looked up the funeral details, hopped on a plane to Leeds, Alabama.
It ain't easy to get to those places. I'm from a very small town.
And my dad showed up for his friend. Afterwards, he went to dinner with Barkley and his family.
For your dad to take the time to come to the funeral meant a great deal to me.
Then, in May 2016, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. He had tumors in his heart. I took that fall off from school. My dad and I watched mobster movies together. Action movies. Kung Fu movies. When the credits rolled, we'd flip to a basketball game. Just me and him, watching a lot of TV in our living room. Days passed by.
Whale of a playoff game in Oklahoma City tonight, and the Thunder even the series in the Western Conference semis with San Antonio.
Then months.
From the set of Saturday Night Live in New York City, it's Inside the NBA.
Hello, hello.
With Charles Barkley.
Then it was 2 years.
And he never told you that he was sick, correct?
No, because I called him and got mad at him when I found out. I was like, dude, we're friends. You can tell me. You're not bothering me. You know me well enough. If you were bothering me, I would tell you you were bothering me.
What Barkley didn't know was that my dad watched him almost every night on TNT. And while he rested and healed, my dad was laughing along with Barkley. He kept my dad company.
I think the Cavs bench is underrated.
June 2018, NBA Finals. Golden State Warriors versus Cleveland Cavaliers. My dad was staying in palliative care at the hospital. He loved the Warriors. I visited and read him sports highlights. He didn't get to watch J.R. Smith's late mistake in Game 1 live when Smith forgot the score. I tried to get him to laugh about Smith dribbling away from the hoop because he thought his team was ahead. But it was a Sunday afternoon, and my dad was tired. The summer light filled his room, then the day faded, and dusk began to enter. After it was all over, I went through my dad's phone and texted all his friends. I wrote, "Hi, this is Shirley. My dad just passed away." The funeral was the day after the NBA Finals. My dad's favorite team, the Golden State Warriors, had won the night before. The funeral was set near the outskirts of Iowa City in a house by the woods. I was talking to my childhood friend when she suddenly looked stunned. I turned to look behind me. And standing there, drenched in sweat from the Iowa summer, towering over everyone in the room at 6 feet 6 inches tall, was Charles Barkley.
I had not met anybody in your family. I didn't know anybody there.
But we all knew you.
Everyone watched, astonished as this man we only knew from TV, this worldwide celebrity, walked down the aisle, looked at us, and sighed. Later, after it all, I texted Barkley and asked him, "Why my dad? Why did he matter so much to you?" And recently, I called him up and asked, "What did you even have to talk about?"
Well, I think, first of all, clearly he was a fan.
Right, big time.
But I think the main thing we talked about was you and your brother.
What did you guys talk about? What did he say?
Well, I think it was more that he was proud. And because I got a daughter, too. I'm just really, really proud of her because I think she's a good person. And your dad was so proud of you and your brother. And we just talked about, listen, as an adult, and you too young to understand this now, man, all you want is your kids to be happy. That's what you work for, to give your kids everything in life.
The more Charles Barkley and I talked, I realized just how close he and my dad were. Barkley knew so much about me and my life, even though this is the first time he and I had ever talked.
It gives me great memories and great joy to know that that I was a friend of his. Just hearing about him at the funeral, what he had accomplished, and what he was trying to help other people accomplish, just made me even. I wish he bragged more about himself.
So let me get this straight: you were impressed by him.
Yeah.
At the funeral, people shared memories of my dad and made me realize that, for example, he was not just a cat litter chemist, but an industry-changing scientist with a PhD, and not just an immigrant, but someone who reached out to Chinese newcomers, and not just a thoughtful guy, but someone people trusted for advice. I realized that even after he passed away, I would continue to learn things about my dad.
Hey, listen, you stay in touch. Please tell your mom I said hello. Give her a big kiss. Tell your brother I said hello. And listen, just keep doing you. It's your time now. Don't forget that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the most important thing. Your dad prepared you to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
He prepared you for that.
All right.
I was blessed to know him. And know you too.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, baby. You take it easy here.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
I know how much his friendship with Charles Barkley meant to my dad. It was not just a relationship with a celebrity. It shed light on the possibilities of this world. A world where someone like him could just say something cool, something charming, and befriend someone like Charles Barkley. I'm so glad that now I get to share my dad's number one dinner party story.
That's reporter Shirley Wong. Coming up, Shirley's going to tell us what's happened since that story first aired last December. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal, dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce, dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
A language was about to die.
Once it gets wiped out, that's it. We will have nothing in our language to pass to our children.
And the people trying to save it were still learning how to speak it.
And we had to hurry up. Time was working against us. We were like 100 years late, you know?
It's Code Switch. Listen and subscribe.
I'm Jason Gay. After our story on the friendship between Charles Barkley and Lin Wang aired last winter, it went viral. Really viral. It got millions of page views. Reporter Shirley Wong wasn't the only one who was surprised.
I've been in the NBA since 1984. I've never gotten a better response or a more positive response of anything I've done in my life than that story with Lin.
That's Charles Barkley on ESPN's Get Up a few days after the story aired.
I'm not exaggerating. I got at least close to 1,000 texts on that story. And I want to thank everybody who sent me a text. Because it was more about Lin than about myself.
Lin Wang's daughter Shirley saw her life change in dramatic ways when her father died. It changed again when the story about him went viral. Here's Shirley.
Every day I think of my dad, who passed away last June. Every other day, I am reminded of him by an object he left behind. That old toothbrush mixed into the clutter on the counter. His shaving kit deep in the bathroom drawers. Sometimes by the startling memory of his face in the middle of a daydream. Lately, however, I've been thinking about him because of Twitter. A few hours after the story aired on Saturday, December 15th, it trended at number 2 on Twitter. My mom's WeChat wouldn't stop buzzing. At 22 years old, I was still an unemployed writer who had just graduated from college. But now I was in front of the world, and the world was greeting me with a hearty, generous offer to engage. It was all because of my dad's story. Conducting phone interviews in a robe in my Iowa bedroom, I neglected my body's command for food and sleep. My mom took off work to feed me quick meals, Milano's and pretzels. My boyfriend logged onto my email from Hong Kong and made an Excel spreadsheet to handle interview requests.
One was an NBA superstar. The other was a successful scientist who worked with cat litter. Charles
heard on NPR's Only a Game and Here and Now and picked up by many, many other media outlets. The storyteller is Shirley Wong.
Everyone's favorite story of the year, her account.
I became used to regular retweets with a link that left me staring at the headline photo, a snap of my dad with his arms spread wide behind Charles Barkley's desk on the set of Inside the NBA. They're reminders of his ability to feel unbridled joy in one of his peak fandom moments. They're reminders that I haven't been able to look at a photo of my dad in a while. Because from this place of incredible internet magic, my excitement was paired with a great sinking sadness. My dad would have loved this. He would have loved that people were listening to the story in the car, his voice floating in the air between a different dad and daughter, or in a college dorm on a Saturday night, or in places as random as the operating room of my mom's boss, who was in the middle of surgery when he decided to play the piece for his attending. He would have framed the letter sent to me by NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who my friends have informed me is the, quote, CEO of basketball. My dad would get a Twitter account with no picture icon so he could retweet celebrities who, after reading the story, decided they admired my dad. But he was gone, and I am here. Sitting at the dinner table, having a frantic breakfast before I had a phone call with the Washington Post, my mom said going viral was a gift from my dad. When I spoke with Charles for the radio story, he said to me,
"Hey, listen, you stay in touch. Please tell your mom I said hello. Give her a big kiss. Tell your brother I said hello. And listen, just keep doing you. It's your time now. Don't forget that.
It's your time now. Don't forget that. I feel I am faced with this new decision. what to do when daily life has proven to be full of unpredictable possibilities, full of extraordinary, ordinary people and the things they can do for each other. A place where beautiful moments are created out of sadness. It's like my dad is saying to me, "Look at this new universe I've opened up for you. Now you will not be lost." To remind me, he sent a whole crowd of internet companions in his place. New friends, new mentors, new wisdom, new relationships to carry on. Sometimes when I miss him, I'll log on, scroll through my Twitter. Even though my dad is gone, online messages leave me with his encouragement. From a dad in Gainesville, Florida.
Your father is that soft voice in your heart and head. He does not shout, he speaks softly to you.
Tweeted one man from Atlanta, Georgia.
Your dad had to be incredibly proud of you, and he still would be.
From a friend from college.
You'll live in the future that you and your dad helped to create.
Transmission sent from the land beyond.
That's reporter Shirley Wong. She recorded her essay from her temporary home in Bolivia, where she's spending time writing. It's time for three stories you should know. This week, for our semi-organized, medium-special Father's Day edition of the show, we've got two dads and one not a dad. My guests are Will Leach, New York Magazine contributing editor. Welcome, Will.
I am a dad.
And Only a Game's very own muckety-muck, Karen Given. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks. I am not a dad.
Take it away, Karen.
Okay, so on Tuesday, this happened.
Is it going to be 13? It is. An emphatic victory for the USA. They win by 13 goals to nil.
I'm happy to say that the controversy over whether the U.S. should have scored those 13 goals against Thailand in their World Cup opener has died down. Goal differential counts in this tournament, and yes, the women should have scored. But we seem to still be talking about whether the women celebrated those 13 goals too much. And I'm really used to ignoring dudes on the internet who ask me such things like if the U.S. women's national team could beat a high school boys team, or if anyone actually cares about their games, because I still believe in facts, and facts are on my side. But in this case, I have seen men that I really admire and respect, dads, if you will, saying things like, if my child did that, I'd stop the game. So dads, are the dads wrong?
For the record, I perhaps there is a handbook to fatherhood that I missed. I do not think fatherhood gives us the power to just stop games, does it? Like, it's worth noting that like the Thailand players didn't seem to be so upset about it. I think this really felt like a way for if you already were skeptical of women's sports or the Women's World Cup, which by the way, you shouldn't. No men's team has ever been watched on American televisions more than the women's team has. Like that was a huge, huge deal that happened 4 years ago. And for me, the idea that the women's team needs to justify anything, if anything, I wish that Thailand actually took their women's sports more seriously.
Yes, the hot take I've been waiting for.
Yes, it's true. But it's not just Thailand. Like across the board, I think that's something we can look at. But the idea that the women's team or anyone is supposed to feel bad for scoring, have these people never watched college football? For crying out loud. That's what the whole thing's about.
Or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or anything. And I feel Will here. And by the way, any show with Will and I on is basically a public service announcement, kids. Stop using caffeine, okay? These are two wildly energized middle-aged men. But I just feel like if the distraction of over-celebration drives you to the point where you are no longer watching the sport, I am very dubious about the fact that you care about the sport at all. And I just want to humble brag for a second. I was there, okay? And it was quite exciting, okay?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If every game had 13 goals, I'd be lining up, all right? It was pretty spicy. I mean, you just turned around to look at the restroom, never mind go to the restroom, and they scored 3 goals. It was an insane atmosphere. These are all home games, effectively, for the United States women's team over in France because there are just so many gaga American soccer fans following around this team.
And I bet no one in the stadium was like, that's no good. The women shouldn't do that.
All right. On to Will Leach. It says here you're a dad extraordinaire, but let's face it, we don't have a confirmation on that, so make of it what you will. Will, what do you have for us?
Okay, so obviously the NBA Finals. Congratulations to the Toronto Raptors. Way to go. Go Canada. Obviously, this was a crazy, crazy NBA Finals. The memory that I think I'm going to stick with is actually that moment where Mark Stevens, the minority owner of the Warriors, pushed Kyle Lowry for jumping into the seats to get a loose ball. I got to think about that. Obviously, much has been made about how Stevens was a minority owner of the team. But I actually find it more interesting to think about the idea of so much of sports now, and particularly the finances of sports, are actually based on these rich dudes that have these seats. I think it's perhaps not surprising that a fan that would pay that much money and sit in those seats, a player would come in and that fan would react, be like, what? This is my area. So I thought this was indicative of a larger issue in both sports and yes, America.
I think you've totally nailed it. Well, this is an issue of privilege, you know, in the wake of that shove heard around the world. I heard some NBA types saying things like, well, we can't move back the seats or put up some sort of barrier because this is what makes our game so special, that everyday ordinary people can sit this close to greatness. And it really should go without saying that spending that much money doesn't give you the right to abuse the players. But it also should go without saying that the fact that you feel like you've paid a bunch of money for your seat at the baseball game and you don't want to sit behind a net is no comfort to the parent whose kid gets beaned. I mean, I really think we have to think about who we're catering to.
I think the solution is in the rock and roll business. Now, a generation ago, when rock bands were selling big ticket prices for their front row seats, they started getting very disappointed that they would look out, Mick Jagger would look down from his snarl mid-concert and see some guy in a three-piece suit not paying attention. The solution was to sort of set aside a bunch of rows in front for super fans. And so they have pushed back, you know, the real fancy pants fans, and they have sort of created this little buffer, this moat, if you will, of cuckoo super fans.
You know what you're describing, it sounds like college basketball, right? College basketball, they put the students, the craziest students, right there on the court and then put the rich donors behind them.
They're getting away from that, Will. I mean, you know, with the Final Four, they have that kind of Potemkin village of like fans.
I do think for like local colleges,
yes,
I would say this. Basically, sports now have become all about exclusive experiences. It's not so much that the seats are so great. It's that they have the seats and you don't.
All right. Enough about you guys. On to me. This has been a terrible, terrible, horrible week for the catastrophic athlete leg injury. Kevin Durant goes down, ruptured Achilles tendon in the NBA Finals, gone for all of next year, presumably. Then, NBA Finals Game 6, Klay Thompson suffers a torn ACL in his knee, his future unknown. These injuries, they're threatening to reshape an entire sport. That's not even the worst leg injury of the week. That awful distinction goes to four-time Tour de France champion Christopher Froome. He crashed into a wall. He broke his femur. He broke his elbow. He busted up some ribs. Froome is one of the best bicyclists in the world. He is always a favorite at the Tour de France. He would have been a favorite to win this year. Now he's out. Who knows what he's going to be like when he comes back. I know you guys might not be the biggest European cycling fans, but this injury, like the Durant injury and Thompson, does, to me, underscore how fragile athletic careers really are. We don't pay attention to that terribly often, but disaster can be really around the corner. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, Froome, especially disaster right around the corner. I mean, you're right. We pay more attention here to basketball, and Kevin Durant's injury was horrifying. And then you think, this guy hit a house at 36 miles per hour, and according to the team doctor, he's already actively engaged in discussing his rehabilitation. It's just incredible to me, sort of the resiliency that comes in cycling.
Yeah, that's such a brutal injury. I'm not actively engaged in being comfortable talking about it yet. We saw this with Kevin Durant this week. Like they had all the top sports scientists and all the doctors all coming together being like, okay, when can Kevin come back? What's our percentage of injury? What can we actually see coming in? You can't. Like the human body is very strange and very unconventional and very weird. And whether it's running into a house or turning on your leg wrong, careers can be over like that.
I mean, there's nothing funny about what happened to Durant, but there is something somewhat amusing about the idea that now you have a player possibly on the downside of his career with a ruptured Achilles. He really hits the sweet spot for the New York Knicks, does it not, Will?
He's never felt more like a Knick. He really hasn't.
All right, my guest for this week's Father's Day, semi-Father's Day, half-organized edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Will Leach, contributing editor to New York Magazine. Thanks, Will.
Shout out to William and Wynn. I'm your dad.
And only a game muckety-muck, Karen Given. Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Jason, and happy Father's Day.
Thank you. My kids will forget. Former major leaguer Dale Barra had a cocaine problem until one morning in 1992 when he got a call from his dad, Yogi.
Come up here. I want to talk to you. So I quickly put on my clothes, knowing full well that something about him was different.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Gregory Warner, and this week on Rough Translation, we follow a rescue mission in real time after an Iraqi photojournalist goes missing on the front lines.
We don't believe it. I don't believe it.
He leaves his family and his friends to try to save him.
When he said, "Who is this?" or like, "Who are you?" They respond, "We are the Islamic State."
This week on Rough Translation.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, a trio of NBA brothers and the sister they say was the best basketball player of all of them. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with this week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
Thursday, Toronto Raptors closed out the Golden State Warriors in six games to win the franchise's first NBA title. The Larry O'Brien Trophy is in Canada. Is this an emergency for basketball in the United States?
No, I'm only disappointed in we didn't get a seventh game because I want to see these two teams play each other again.
Yeah.
If basketball can be described as beautifully inartistic, that's what this series was. Just watching Boogie Cousins try to get up and down the floor and the manful effort he put in to get up and down the floor and the demonstration that Kawhi Leonard might well be the best two-way player in the league. It was a revelation. They were two very attractive teams, and I don't want any hot takes about how, you know, this has somehow got an asterisk hung on it because everybody on Golden State got hurt.
They were well on their way to winning that series before any of these injuries happened.
I agree. Think.
At this point, Kawhi Leonard, finals MVP, free agent this summer, he has to stay, right? It seems crazy to think that he'll be suiting up somewhere else next season.
Were I him, I would stay. He's not going to get a better situation. He might get a situation that's equal to the one he has in Toronto for more money. I would announce that I was staying in Toronto. I like Toronto. It's a great city, very diverse. They've treated me well here. But since Kawhi Leonard has at least, judging by his interviews, no apparent pulse, I don't know what he's thinking.
But I just find, like, metabolically, he fits the town, he fits the team. The team kind of became him. I just feel like it's just a perfect fit. And these guys, fundamentally, what they're after is fit. And everything is, seems to be there except for warm weather of Southern California, where he's from.
Yeah, and the free agent market is going to be obliterated until Anthony Davis decides what he's doing.
This is true.
If I was Kawhi, I'd make Toronto pay what I want, and I would stay.
All right, moving over to hockey, Charlie. The St. Louis Blues prevailed over the Boston Bruins in Game 7 to take the Stanley Cup this past Wednesday. Bully for those Blues. What a season. Worst to first. First ever franchise title. As an out-of-nowhere championship run goes, this has to be pretty high up there, is it not?
Oh, it's terrific. The only reason I hesitate to rank it was because I didn't pay any attention to the Blues for the first half of the season. So I have no idea. But, I mean, not only that, but you've got Jordan Binnington, off the scrap heap goalie, yeah, standing in his head, as we hockey heads say, in the deciding Game 7. A real disappointing performance by the Boston Bruins.
Yeah.
Their best players did not play well, and they just sort of rolled over and died. Brad Marchand will be marked forever for wanting to leave the ice with 7 seconds left in the period and allowing the second goal, which pretty much broke the game open at that point, the way Binnington was playing. No, I'm very happy for the St. Louis Blues.
All right. Well, the Forbes list of the world's highest paid athletes is out. Canelo Alvarez, the boxer from Mexico, he's fourth on the list, $92 million in winnings, just $2 million in endorsements. On the other hand, you got Roger Federer, who's earned $7.4 million on the tour, but $86 million in endorsements. Is it time for Canelo Alvarez to get Roger Federer's agent or something?
Either that or get him in the ring, one or the other. I mean, you got to give Federer credit. He's the only tennis player in the top 10. And he's also, you know, over 40 years old. And he's still considered, A, a really good player, and B, a really good commodity. The top three are soccer players, which is probably not surprising. The next two, and the first two in American team sports, are both quarterbacks. Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers. So again, the NBA numbers are lower than they used to be.
It's true. I with Federer, I think that, you know, he's just always getting those classy endorsements. It's always Mercedes and Rolex and stuff. You never see Roger Federer for like Skittles or like Dr. Scholl's.
Or Auto Glass or something. Hair replacement surgery.
You should just do one Auto Glass spot. It would be so great. The noted former heavyweight boxer and homing pigeon enthusiast Mike Tyson is broadening his horizons. Why don't you tell us a little bit about his latest venture, Charlie?
Yes, Mike is opening a 400-acre cannabis resort.
What?
Yes, in California. It's apparently a place where you can check in and do all sorts of resort things and also get really stoned. In my day, that was called campus, but what do I know? And they're going to have, and this I love, they're having the world's longest lazy river, which it takes an hour to float down.
That is lazy.
That river is going to have traffic jams like you wouldn't believe. The catch is that you can smoke your dope anywhere on the resort, but you can't buy any there.
Huh.
It's a BYOD resort.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
Let's be real. Dads do not need any more ties for Father's Day. We're tied up with ties. But here's a gift that keeps on giving, one that you don't have to color coordinate with your khakis and Skechers. It's the Only a Game podcast. Subscribe, and Only a Game will appear in your feed every week. One day in 1992, very early in the morning, Dale Barrow was summoned to what he calls a tribunal. There, in the den of his parents' home in Montclair, New Jersey, Dale's father, Yogi, led the proceedings.
He simply said to me, "You won't be my son anymore if you continue to use cocaine."
Dale Barrow says those words came from a man who was more complex than most people ever knew. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Yogi Berra won 10 World Series and 3 MVPs in his long Yankees career. He was a celebrity and a big league manager with the Yankees and Mets. But when the three Berra boys went to their dad for baseball advice,
he didn't want to teach us. He'd say, "Go watch Cleon Jones hit. He'll show you how to hit the ball to right field." Or if I want to take ground balls, he'd say, "Watch Bud Harrelson take ground balls. Do it that way."
All three Barra sons excelled in sports. Dale graduated high school in 1975. 2 years later, he was playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Barra was a reliable utility infielder and a member of the Pirates' World Series-winning 1979 team.
Okay, Dale Barra to lead it off in the Pirate third.
In 1982, he led all National League shortstops in home runs, RBI, and total runs. He was finally an everyday player.
He's having so much more fun, and I think it's obvious. You play better baseball when you're having fun. You're relaxed. He's really enjoying it right now.
Dale Barra thought he was on his way to a long and successful career. But two seasons later, Dale was struggling. In one 1984 game between the Pirates and the Dodgers...
You know, I'm facing Don Sutton with that curveball that starts behind your left ear and ends up over the outside corner down and away. And I struck out 3 times.
At the time, Yogi was managing the Yankees, but he'd keep his eye on the Pirates' box scores. That same day, Yogi was in the Yankees' dugout for a game in Kansas City.
So between innings, he calls our trainer's room. The trainer comes out and says, "Dale, your dad's on the phone." And I say, "What do you mean? He's managing a game in Kansas City." And he goes, "Oh, here he is." And I said, "Dad, you're managing." He goes, "Don't worry about what I'm doing. It's between innings. I got the box score. How'd you strike out 3 times?" You know, my dad would only strike out 12 or 15 times in an entire year. And I'd strike out that many times in a week. I said, Dad, Don Sutton's really tough to hit. And he said, he is? He's got to throw it over the plate, doesn't he?
What Yogi didn't realize was that Dale was dealing with an even bigger problem than Don Sutton's curveball. It had begun on New Year's Eve, 4 years earlier, in 1980. Some of Dale's friends had brought cocaine to a party.
I said, you know what, let me try it. And I tried it. And you know what happened? It's a very simple thing. With no intellectualizing it now, I loved it. I liked it too damn much.
Barra says he used cocaine for the rest of his major league career. During those years, he considered his drug use to be, in his words, recreational and responsible.
To me, an addict was a guy laying on the street with a needle in his arm, or a guy shaking in the corner and couldn't control himself, or a guy missing games and missing team buses and flights and not showing up for practice. That was an addict, not me.
Dale Barra's habit didn't cause him to miss games or practices, but it wasn't helping either. In 1984, he went on to strike out 78 times in 450 at-bats. He batted just .222.
I should have been getting a lot better. I should have had a breakout year. That is the year where the use of cocaine caught up to me. I didn't realize that it was taking away the split-second timing that it takes to hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball or do the geometry on a slicing line drive hit by Mike Schmidt. But I justified it because I never missed a game. I never missed a plane. I never was late. I never played the game on cocaine. All those things told me I had no problem when it was robbing me of my skills. And I was too dumb to realize it. It's the biggest regret of my life.
Had you known that a trade to the team your father had managed was in the works?
No, I had no idea.
Dale Barra was traded to the New York Yankees on December 20th, 1984.
The opportunity to play for my father was a dream come true.
Yogi confided to a handful of friends that it was a dream come true for him, too. But he didn't tell Dale that.
I was driving in to the stadium with him for the day of the publicity shoot where they were announcing the trade. He drove, and I said to him, so, Dad, this is a big day. What do you think? He goes, I think you won't play unless you hit, kid. And I said, oh, okay. He goes, you know, I'm not going to treat you any different than the other players. If you hit, you play.
But during the offseason, months before Dale even had his first at-bat for the Yankees, he was staying in his parents' Montclair home when the doorbell rang.
It was very early in the morning. My mom and dad were both home. I was upstairs in the bedroom, and I came downstairs.
It was the FBI.
All they said to me was, we would like you to come to Pittsburgh to testify in front of a grand jury about cocaine in Pittsburgh and Major League Baseball. Dad came in and said, what's this all about? And I said, they just want to know about some cocaine stuff in Pittsburgh. Dad said, are you okay? Are you in trouble? And I said, no. I said, I'm not, Dad, and I am okay. He trusted me, and he believed me, because I thought I was.
Dale was asked to testify in September, but in the meantime, there was baseball to play. On the first day of 1985 spring training, Dale needed to ask a question. As is the baseball custom, he addressed his manager as Skip.
And Ron Guidry got up right in the middle of the team meeting and said, in his Cajun accent, he said, Dale, that man is not your Skip. That man is your dad. From now on, when you speak to him, I don't ever want to hear the word Skip out of your mouth. It's Dad. Yogi, you call him son. And that took all the pressure off us right then and there.
The season began, and Dale realized that the Yankees loved playing for his dad.
It was wonderful to hear Mattingly talking about Yogi and what a great manager he is. And Don Baylor going, gosh darn it, come on. Let's go out there and win for Yogi. I loved playing for him because he's my dad. It was a tremendous experience for 16 games.
The injury-depleted Yankees struggled out of the gate. George Steinbrenner had promised to stick with Yogi for the whole season. But on April 28th, the Yankees lost to the White Sox in Chicago.
After the game, I go into the clubhouse and there's guys cursing. Baylor's in the shower throwing food in the shower. Mattingly's cursing up a storm throwing a garbage can. Ken Griffey Sr.'s crying at his locker. Ron Guidry is crying at his locker. They said to me, go into your dad's office. So I walked in there and I said, Dad, what's going on? He said, they got rid of me, Dale. And I wanted to console him.
But Yogi would have none of that. Instead, he delivered what might have been the most poignant of his Yogi-isms. You have your future ahead of you. Mine is behind me. Yogi Berra never managed another team. Toward the end of that season, Dale Berra testified along with several other major leaguers at the Pittsburgh drug trials. Six men were found guilty of distributing cocaine. 11 players, including Berra, were suspended. Commissioner Peter Uberoff commuted all 11 suspensions in exchange for community service and fines. Berra played one more year for the Yankees and then another for the Houston Astros. He retired in 1987.
I could have been a lot better. Cocaine took what I think would have been an all-star type career.
It also took his first marriage. That ended in 1989 after a conviction for cocaine possession. Dale's drug use continued for a few more years, and then his family had had enough.
And Dad, knowing my history, called my brothers and said, that's it. I've had enough. I'm no longer going to ask him if he's okay, because I don't trust him anymore.
And that brings us back to that early morning in 1992. Dale's phone rang. It was his dad.
Come up here. I want to talk to you. So I quickly put on my clothes, knowing full well that his inflection was different. Something about him was different.
Dale arrived at the Berra's Montclair home. His mother and two brothers were in the den. His father presided over what Dale now calls a tribunal.
He simply said to me, your brothers over there are not going to be your brothers anymore. Your father sitting here will not be your father anymore. And you won't be my son anymore if you continue to use cocaine. And don't tell me that you don't use it. If you ever use it again, you have no family. I was shot through the heart. In that instant, the obsession, the compulsion was lifted from me. And that was 27 years ago. And I have never wanted or never even gave thought to another drink or drug. We never even talked about that again. Dad wouldn't even bring it up again. He didn't. He just knew I was okay.
These days, Dale Berra and his wife Jane are raising two daughters, age 14 and 12. Yogi attended his granddaughter's softball and lacrosse games before he died in 2015. Dale says he's thinking about him a lot this Father's Day weekend.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Dale Berra's new book is My Dad, Yogi.